My name is Lisa. This is Alan over here.
Hello, everybody.
He's taking care of the technical difficulties, which always happen. We are Radios Populares. We're a collective from Chicago. And we've just finished a workshop on transmitter building. So in this workshop or this discussion, we're hoping it to be discussion as well. We're going to go through a little bit of what our group is, what the model is that we use. We work with community radios in Latin America. And then we're going to have a little sort of discussion sharing about why we use radio, the tool of radio, and how it can function in different settings as a tool of creating agency in a community with the people that we work with. So.
And if you have any questions throughout, please feel free to raise your hand or whatever you want to do to ask questions.
So first we want to talk a little bit about the model that we work with. We work with communities in Latin America in a solidarity model. And we say solidarity because that's kind of how we, from identifying and connecting with the different communities we work with to fundraising to going down there and setting up our equipment, it's all kind of based on the solidarity with the struggle that the community or the organization that we're working with has identified as why they want radio, why they think that the radio could be a tool to advance their community goals, to advance the struggles that they're working in. And so when we say solidarity versus charity versus development, it's kind of some different ideas that we use to go about how we work with communities. And I guess we could talk a little bit about the process. We have five communities that we've worked in.
A couple of times.
So the communities that we worked in, we started in 2002. And the first station was in Honduras. Correct me if I'm wrong. Then in Nicaragua, in Ecuador, Bolivia, and
Mexico.
In Mexico. And so the... Does anybody want to talk about how connections happen with the stations?
Okay, maybe it's helpful to talk about how the project came to start in the first place. Jump in if you want. But in Chicago, there was a transmitter that suddenly became homeless because there was a pirate station that had to go off the air, and there was a transmitter sitting around. And at the same time in Chicago, there was a lot of people working in community radio, pirate radio in Chicago. And then there's also a lot of solidarity work that goes on in different circles. And Alan and Aaron at the time had the were working just, you know, in the same circle with this group called La Voz de los de Abajo, which has done solidarity work in Honduras over the years. And they were working with a community organization, actually a national organization in Honduras that was about land struggle. And that organization had identified radio as a useful organizing tool. So just being able to put the resources together is what really led to that first project. So that was sort of the first project. And what we learned from that was that their community radio is really powerful in other parts of the world, and we can talk a little bit more about that later. But it plays maybe a more important and more vibrant role in many ways outside of what our experience in the U.S. often. And at the same time, it was a useful solidarity type of role because the pieces, the equipment, and all of that was just much harder to get in some of the countries that we were providing support in. So that was sort of the need that we identified, that we had the resources to be able to contribute. So back to what Lisa said, how we envision this as a solidarity model, it really is that we're working with communities that are involved in different social justice struggles and who see radio as a tool in their toolkit or to use for their organizing goals, not just for the sake of... Oh, I'm so sorry. Not just wanting to have a radio station for the sake of a radio station, even though that can be a really important goal in and of itself. This is really more of using radio as a tool for educating and communicating, basically, which, of course, you throw in entertainment as well.
Every single one of the communities that we've worked in have had, they fall under the umbrella of social justice struggles or progressive struggles, and that is a huge umbrella, right? And so they've all got a lot of what would seem like very disparate kind of like goals. But when you start to piece together, like one in Nicaragua, a women's cooperative, in Ecuador, an indigenous community, in Mexico, another like a youth-led cultural and Zapote community, in Bolivia, a theater group, street theater youth group. You know, so like they're all like very particular types of activities that they've been using to like kind of like help promote social justice and also engage politically in many other aspects of that struggle. They all recognize like the need for access and communication and to be able to like voice and kind of like make a declarative statement that says we have agency. And radio in those scenarios played like one of the most critical roles for that, because everyone, despite like the advent of newer technologies, you know, like the internet or cell phones or a variety of other things, radio is still considered like the most accessible tool in those arenas. Everyone has radio. There's a long-standing history in the majority world of people using radios. They're still like the principal thing. You may not have cell phone towers, you may not have computers, you may not have even interest in times into delving into those things, but people out in the middle of very rural areas will have little transistor radios that they listen to. One particular example that we like to share is like the women's co-op in Nicaragua. And this just to kind of like identify a little bit of what does like power and agency mean in regards to like the power to communicate. We have a little short video we'll show in a little bit about it, but a cooperative of women in Murucucu in Nicaragua, and I don't know how many folks may have a understanding of Nicaragua's history, but obviously through the 1980s there was an incredible amount of U.S. funded and supported and directed repression against the country of Nicaragua, and this co-op was kind of, to a great degree, was born out of that organizing capacity that they had as revolutionaries. But having transitioned into the electoral process in which, you know, the liberal parties won in Nicaragua, the women started to like try to like organize in their community, kind of like a healing process between former ex-Contra fighters, which now repopulated the region of Murucucu, which is the town that they're in, and also the Sandinistas, you know, because at the end of the day, they would say, well, you know, we're all campesinos. We're all kind of being crushed by the same economic pressures and also other forms of repression. So when Hurricane Joan hit the region, they formed this co-op to, like, make bricks to rebuild the homes, not just of the Sandinistas, but of everyone in the area that wanted to participate and collaborate together and work together. When they went through that stage, they then organized with the assistance of Dorotea Granada from the U.S., a Chicana nurse from the U.S., to start help open up a clinic, a women and children's clinic, because infant mortality rates were incredible in this region. In this region, which takes 7 hours 7 hours minimum by car to get through this bumpy road that washes out all the time. So in this area, there was like power. When we first went there, power was only on about 10 hours a day on a good day. They only had one radio station in the area. The water was available through a diesel engine pump that would always conk out, you know, that was pumped out. So it was a lot of hardship in that area, but also a lot of potential for development, appropriate development. So when the women made this health clinic, it had a really, really powerful impact in the entire community, not just the people who live in there, but the people in the outlying areas as well. Having this clinic, everyone loved it. It was such a very clear necessity. You know, it saved lives. It you know, just did a lot of, like, incredible things. During the course of them having, like, a women and children's clinic, they just, you know, they started to, like, address domestic violence. Because those became some of the, you know, presumably if someone comes to the clinic, you know, you start to notice maybe patterns of violence, you know, going on. And so then they started to address domestic violence. All of a sudden, not everyone liked the co-op. In fact, the only radio station in the community, in this town, about 4,000 people at the time, they say 4,000 or 5,000 people, would go on the air to denounce the women as guerrilla fighters and witches, literally. And it was an evangelical radio station that would kind of promote ideas that, you know, women were just like property of the man, the cat, like just like his cattle, just like, you know, and if a man feels he can beat his cattle, then he can beat his wife. these were the types of ideas being promoted by the station. So the women in the community, in the actual town, everyone knew what the women were about, and they were just like, you know, whatever with this evangelical station. But the most vulnerable population were the ones out in the farther outlying areas where it could take up to 2 days by horseback in order to reach the town. You know, so those, all of a sudden, you know, women that are, you know, 7 months pregnant or anyone or children in poor health were not being let into the town, or there wasn't an incentive for them to come down if, like, they felt like, I'm going to deal with these, like, witches or whatever, you know, that was being. And, I mean, it really shows the power of language. I mean, we see it in kind of, like, right-wing talk show stuff here where people just, like, spew all this vitriol, and it's amazing. Everyone knows it's garbage, but so much of it sticks, you know? And it's kind of like, really? So obviously that was the intention, I think, with this evangelical station. So then at that point, they recognized that even though they weren't necessarily interested in having their own radio station, they wanted to accomplish all these other things. And they said radio is going to be a very functional, useful tool to help facilitate that, help it grow, and help the entire community at large grow. So, I mean, that's kind of a long-winded example of just, like, one of the ways that people are doing other types of struggles. They're, like, not necessarily media activists, per se, in their communities, but have recognized what a powerful tool the institution, in some ways, of media is, you know, like having a station, having, you know, the infrastructure, I should say.
La cooperativa María Luisa Ortiz fue fundada en Nicaragua en 1988 para ayudar a reconstruir el pueblo de Murucucú y comunidades alrededor después del daño causado por Huracán Juana y 10 años de guerra. Trabajando con la cooperativa, en la primavera del 2004, miembros de Radio Populares viajaron a Nicaragua para establecer una estación de radio para la comunidad de Murucucú.
Ahí mi amigo la vas a escuchar.
is an organization based in Chicago called the Working Bikes Cooperative. And what they do is they refurbish bikes that are donated and they take them to other parts of the world as well. And one of the places that they had taken bikes was this community in Nicaragua. And so because they're based in Chicago, we know the people that are part of this collective. And so they came to us and said, we just took a trip there, and this group of people really, really wants to have a radio station. And that was after we had already set up the station in Honduras. So since we were formally a group then, they came to us and said that that's what they wanted, and that basically we took about a year to raise the funds, which is at least what it takes us to raise the funds for each of the stations. And luckily, one of the members of the community was able to come to the United States, and we got to meet with him, because part of it is figuring out the lay of the land, what it looks like, the geography of it, to be able to set up the station. So we met with him, found out what they were looking for, and then they... You saw the tower that they built, which helps in the range of that station. So it was a 150-foot tower that they got people to build, and we helped give some of the funding for the tower.
So it takes us about a year to raise funds for it, and I know that, at least for us, sometimes we sit around going like, wow, it takes us forever. But it's actually for us, because of our model, like that we feel is solidarity, it's a solidarity project. It's also like it's become kind of an integral part of what this relationship development means in the way that we work with the communities. We never feel comfortable about being like guns for hire. You know, like someone says, hey, I need a station, come on down. And we're like, oh, okay. You know, for us, it's really important to try to understand the context and also like to develop a relationship with the community that we're going to go work with. And that's really done over time, right? And it's not going to happen just like, oh, instantly. Because for us, it's almost like following like the health side of things of like, you know, the do no harm principle. So in many situations, there's nuanced and sometimes very critical kind of aspects to what kind of struggle they're engaged in. And if someone shows up and just kind of like promotes like, hey, set up this radio station, it can go from like creating divisions within the community to getting people killed. You know, and so like those types of things are things that we want to take very seriously in both developing an understanding of what is the station going to go to. Because once we say, okay, we support this community and what they're doing, we choose not to have any say in the content or in the manner in which they use it, whether it's legal or licensed, I should say, or unlicensed, or you know, or what types of pursuits, or should it transition for the sake of sustainability into some other type of usage, on top of what initially seemed to be like the most pragmatic.
The length of time also is reflective of the fundraising we do, which is pretty much like events where it's a lot of pass the hat donations. Most events sort of reflect what the project is, and we try to not just take people's money and just be like, oh, this is for a good cause, but have people understand who the community is we're working with. A lot of it's based on connections of solidarity between groups already in Chicago. So La Voz de los Abajo is a group that we've worked with that works in Honduras with a landless peasants group. And so they help do actions around land takeovers and stuff. And so working with them on different events and the people that support them understanding that the station that we worked with was with them. So it ends up being a kind of a community that's formed between the two places. And people ask us, how is the station doing? And part of what we do is also follow-up. So there's been a couple follow-up trips to Nicaragua now. Follow-up meaning we communicate with them constantly. They say, you know, I think we're ready for a little more powerful transmitter, or the computer has some glitches. We're trying to work on it, but, you know, we could use some software like this. So the fundraising model is also kind of under, and whenever we come back from a station, we always do a report back, kind of coming back to the people who had donated and saying, this is how it went, and this is this is what the people say about what was installed and stuff.
So. And another part of that is also not wanting to commit to more than we can do. So we've been very careful to discuss amongst the group what we think we're capable of doing in that amount of time. And what we always tell the groups we work with is we provide the equipment and give them an understanding of what level we're talking about. We're not going to provide a 10,000-watt station. You know, we're not going to provide a huge studio that's going to be built, you know, state-of-the-art by U.S. standards. And so we explained very much what it's going to look like, how many watts we're talking about, what kind of range it could be, which is variable. And also that we're providing the equipment, the actual physical equipment, and then we're providing training, usually over the course of a week or two, that we're physically there, but that we are not going to be on the ground after that as individuals. So we try to have it as much installed and working when we leave, ideally. But that after that, we're not providing like stipends so that they can stay on the air. So we always have long discussions with the groups about, you know, how are you going to provide the electricity, for example? Do you have funds for that? How can we work with you to maybe come up with some ideas? But that's not... We want to make sure that the groups understand what we can provide and what we can't, so that they, which is why we've also worked with groups that have been around for a long time, and this is just a part of their work, you know. So that's an important piece.
It also gives time for them to really work out the details of what station management's going to look like, because we think that actually bringing the equipment down and leaving it set up is the easy part, and the much harder part is getting people working together around their goals with the station and learning how to bring new people in and having the people power to sustain a project like this. Like, any of you who've worked with radio, and I know there's people here who have, know that, like, to produce, you know, a 3-minute segment, you know, you're spending much, much more time doing the recordings, doing the editing, and getting pieces together. And so it's a big undertaking. And so it gives them time, and we kind of, through conversation, give them some questions to think about. But they're the ones deciding how will they organize to keep this going. And that, we feel like, needs time as well before the equipment is in their hands. Otherwise, it's just too likely the equipment could get put in a corner because there's infighting or there's a lack of agreement about how to proceed or who's on the air, who has what show, you know, all those kinds of things.
Did you have a question that you wanted to ask?
I'm wondering if you can speak more about your fundraising model and for, like, how many people are in your collective, and do you make a conscious decision to not apply for grants? Like, it seems like probably a lot of your money or a lot of your time is spent trying to find money, and it seems like you do so in the most grassroots way possible. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with, like, grant stipulations. And
grant stipulations is definitely a concern, you know, because we're not out to, like, limit who we work with and what capacity based on some grant requirements. The other part is, we don't necessarily, because this is born out of solidarity work, we're not necessarily looking for traditional, like, NGO model where it's like, oh, this becomes my full-time job, you know, thank goodness there's, like, development work for me to do somewhere that can pay for, you know, this type of activity. So it is like, part of that for us helps create a non-paternalistic relationship, or that we're gatekeepers to larger access of funds, you know, for the communities. And this is all part of, like, the making sure that they understand our limitations as well, so that the communities situations where there was failure's too strong a word, I think, but where there were difficulties. And some of those stemmed from these, and they were learning experiences for us as well. We did a project in Juchitán, Mexico, where it was Zapotec Youth, and their programming was great. I mean, they would send us copies of it, and it's just like, wow, this is great, in Zapotec and in Spanish. And also they were doing a lot of, like, informing people around Plan Puebla Panama, part of the transcontinental, you know, the highway that was going to be built. It's still, like, a major part of it, which was zeroing in on that isthmus region of Mexico. But they didn't, I mean, they were a small group and involved in art and cultural programs and other things. You know, it's kind of like us, but doing about 17 other things as well as their own radio station, right? So then they had brought in other people, I think, in probably kind of like an out of necessity, but a clunky kind of way. They were from the local university. And those two groups had a falling out to the point where one stole the radio gear from the station that we had set up, you know, and things got resolved, and eventually they decided, well, we can't give the gear the type of functioning that we would like to give, so they gave it away to the other group, and we were totally fine with that. But at the same time, we were like, and there was, like, particular kinds of requests that were like, well, you know, it's not like we can tell, we're like, we don't own that gear, we can't tell the university group that you've been working with to give back the gear. You know, it's like, we, you know, and so, like, those types of, like, things that became kind of like sticky issues that kind of taught us a little bit of like what are the types of questions that people not even so much have to answer to us, but really ask themselves as they undertake a project of building a radio station. What type of sustainability and human infrastructure do you have in place, and mutual goals are you trying to achieve with it that would allow a station to blossom as opposed to become, to some degree, a burden?
One thing that station in Nicaragua has been dealing with is deciding whether they will allow songs on the radio that the women of the cooperative feel are offensive to women, for example. There's a lot of youth that have programming that play a lot of reggaeton. That was the big issue that was going. The reggaeton music that they were playing, some of the women would be listening to the station and they would be like, I don't want to hear this. This is my station that I helped start. But then how to balance that with, you know, allowing the youth the voice that they wanted to have and play the kind of music that they wanted to have. It was creating a really great opportunity for dialogue and discussion, but difficult issues that come up when you have things being very open, but also being controlled and going towards a mission that the women who had started the station had in the idea of, you know, from the beginning and the way that it started. So I don't think it's resolved. I think they're still working on it and deciding what the best way is to deal with that.
I mean, some like just blossoming out of that was like the types of questions that I think they would ask. It's not so much like an issue that the youth are playing it, but kind of like, well, why are they playing it? You know, and then how to grow from there, you know, like what, you know, like using that. And they did on at least on a couple occasions. And some of the youth, particularly the young boys, the young males, were more, some of them more receptive than others, clearly, to like this type of like, let's dialogue about this. Like, what does respect mean? And why is it, why would some people feel disrespectful and stuff? You know, and that, I think, has been like the really great example, while at the same time recognizing that that's going to dissuade some of the youth from wanting to be a part of that station, because they have to unlearn like the models that they hear on commercial stations, which have no respect for anyone, you know. So like there's a continuous process that's kind of been shown there.
I was just going to say, like, how do you see your work in building on the media justice movement that's been kind of jump-started in Latin America? I mean, Latin America, the Sandinistas always were using radio and everywhere, but the growing media justice movement that's basically very youth of color driven, that's popping up all over in the States. How do you, I guess you can say, like, you have a collective of people within Chicago. I guess I'm looking at the collective, right? But how, I guess I'm curious about on the stateside level, how do you bring more people or create consciousness about the importance of this work with people in North America? You know, I mean, I know that your movement work was basically, you were more activist doing Latin American solidarity work first before you became more media justice advocates and activists. But I guess, I don't know what my question is, I'm losing it, but maybe you can maybe bounce off just the idea of how can we make this more of something where it's a great community building model. It's something that I see could be working even within the States, or bringing just more people into this kind of work that you do, getting people trained, capacity built, you know, within Chicago, for example.
I think we try to bridge those two things more and more over the years. We've really, I think, kind of more prioritized trying to do that, partly by doing educational work in Chicago. The building the kits is newer for us this year, but for the last many years, we've been doing kind of workshops with, like, very hands-on, getting people the chance to get on to equipment and see how easy it is to go on air, and, like, just really emphasizing that, you know, we're not engineers. We don't even, you know, work with a community station in Chicago. There really isn't a community station in Chicago that we would want to work at. But just having the opportunity for people to see how accessible and easy it is and get excited about it. And then we've been doing some more stuff around web streaming and other things that are maybe a little bit easier in that context for people to actually implement, you know, go beyond the learning and wow stage to, okay, let me actually put this into practice. And I think that's a way of also connecting them back to the solidarity work in other places, because, you know, unfortunately in the U.S., it's very difficult to get a community station going. Pirate stations have really, you know, and a new law was, you know, just signed into into being last year, and so there's a new window for more licensing for community stations, so maybe there'll be more some more activity around that. But
Prometheus Radio.
Right.
Yeah. So we've worked very closely with Prometheus over the years and supporting them in their barn raisings, and kind of like I think we see them as having this really important role in helping to support getting community radio going in the U.S., and we support them more from an educational point of view, like we'll come out and do workshops and things like that and help.
And I think that there's this idea, how we work as a group too, like we don't have an engineering background, so we will kind of figure things out as we go, sort of do internal trainings where we train each other on stuff that we have learned on our own or stuff that we can maybe work through together. And I think as you get into the, like, what is radio? Okay, we have a community station. We have an NPR, National Public Radio Station. There's this professionalism that just gets like, this pristine sound that you have to have. And that kind of creates a lot of barriers for people to engage, and also for, you know, this piece of news is not important enough. We only have this much space. So it's just having, like, people understand that there is, you know, there's other ways to engage in media and to share media, and a community station might not have this pristine, you know, we call it NPR sound or whatever, but it's tied to a community. It's not something that is coming down that you're just in taking one way. It's sort of a two-way conversation, maybe. So that's the bigger struggle, and I think that we have that conversation. And we try in our workshops to kind of bring this actual, like, building a little transmitter to maybe that conversation. But the real connections haven't happened yet. And so maybe with this new legislation, there's more community radio, and that can be more of a future.
And we have gone to, I mean, some sort of media justice events in the U.S., and we've often tried to, if we've given presentations focused on the actual technology side, because usually the media justice discussions are usually around content. It almost always seems to be about content
or policy,
and it's rarely about, like, actually the physical, technology itself. So we've tried to focus the discussions, at least changing the discussions a little bit, to be, well, who, of course people are talking about who controls the technology. I mean, we all know who Clear Channel is and all these big companies, but talking about you can actually try and have the technology yourself, who controls it, who is actually, you know, behind the curtain of it. And that's some way we've engaged in, I guess, the discussion nationally within the U.S., but we often do get, well, I guess I'll speak for myself, it gets frustrating to talk about just the content aspect and maybe trying to get certain kinds of content on the big stations, as opposed to just saying, well, screw the big stations in the first place. And
I mean, the elephant in the room is, like, to go pirate or to not go pirate, right? And for us, some of us have pirate experience, you know, and stuff, which there was a little movement to reclaim the word community instead, you know, that the pirates were the large owners, you know, that have been stealing from us. But I think, like, for us, the way we've seen it is that direct action and direct implementation of your ideals, you know, is really what's going to like actually implement some sort of sense of agency and some sort of sense of, you know, like, a change. And there, you know, thereby it's like, do we continue to, like, stay knocking at the door to be let in to this exclusive club, which also kind of, like, waters down our messaging through the notions of professionalism, you know, or other types of, like, messaging or wording? Or do we start to say, well, you know what, we can continue to do that because it is very important work, and we can also, like, engage in, like, actually saying, I can have some sort of agency, I can build radio stations here, I can learn from those examples. We can even take to the airwaves here again, where, interestingly enough, like, a lot of this legislation that came about is only, has, like, the low power FM movement really was only born out of, you know, on-air civil disobedience that, you know, like, was through the 60s and 70s and 80s, and then with a big resurgence, like, around the 80s, late 80s, you know. And so, like, none of those things would have really happened. We wouldn't even be at that stage, I think, in regards to, like, where this potential legislation may go if people hadn't taken direct action or done civil disobedience. So, but the more detached that we as a society come from that technology, the less likely it would be that there could be another upsurge of that, you know, like, you know, technological civil disobedience, you know. And so for us, I mean, like, it's like those are like much larger kind of like discussions and stuff. But really it's that when people, when we've noticed like people going on the air, and despite like maybe some of the frustrations earlier in the workshop earlier, you know, going on the air and recognizing like, oh, wow, I can do this. You know, it really opens up, I think, a lot of potentials for where do you take it from here, you know? I mean, and that could mean I will get more involved in the media justice movement in the sense of content or policy, or getting involved with other groups that are looking to get a licensed station, or even, like, going, you know, like, being prepared at least for going in another direction that says, I'm going to challenge the status quo in some way, shape, or form. You know, and so for us, like, us doing, like, the things, it's like we didn't see, like, oh, we're going to try to find a group that's already doing something, you know, in Latin America and try to join up with that. We said, oh, well, why don't we just do it in, you know, in a way. And so, you know, like we like to say, if people as incompetent as us could do it, anyone can, you know, and we really believe that. And I think we demonstrate the incompetency sometimes really well. But it really boils down to that. And, like, that's what, like, the actual engagement with the technology for us really represents. There are actually a couple things that I'd like to point out to. One is we've done a lot of work in Honduras, and also we're friends with stations in El Salvador, a particular station there, which is receiving a lot of death threats right now, particularly as a result of the mining issues in the Cabañas region of El Salvador. And it's like an amazing radio station that we've actually connected to a station in Honduras and are also, excuse me, building connections to their station in Nicaragua, because they're neighboring stations and their contexts are like, they're so parallel in many ways. But the station in El Salvador is like a phenomenal example of like growing out of like what used to be like a guerrilla radio station. And then they developed a model that I think blows away any model I've seen anywhere for community licensing stations. So this station that used to be part of Radio Venceremos, would have never received a license from the government directly. But what they did is they developed ARPIS, like kind of like Asociación de Radios Populares del Salvador, Association of Popular Radios of El Salvador. And so they made an association that wasn't that station, and they got a national level frequency. So, like, there, I think it's like 97.9 or something FM, right? So now ARPIS distributes the frequencies to the community stations throughout the country, you know? And it's kind of like, oh, well, duh, that's brilliant. That, because these stations are 100 watt or maybe 200 watt. I mean, they're literally meant for their communities in particular, you know? And so it makes sense that every single community could have the same frequency because they're not going to interfere with each other at, you know, at those distances. And I look at, like, models like that, and I'm like, in the U.S., why don't we have, or... In the U.S., I don't think Canada has anything like that either. You know, it's like there's these models that are kind of born out of kind of corporate kind of like, you know, like identifying ways, and they continue to be like considerable giveaways, particularly with this digital transition, which I'm not allowed to talk about because it gets really boring really fast. But in El Salvador, for instance, like in that station that's doing all these things, they are right now under very particular death threats for their radio journalism that they've developed, which is actually a pretty phenomenal model of community journalism that has challenged like the mining industry. It has challenged the government. It has challenged, you know, like the random violence like of drug trafficking, you know, and in a variety of other ways that it's just been such an integral part of that community for now, like, I think about 17 years or so. I'd love to give out more information about that. like, if it was a flat playing field that it said, okay, this community, we all start a station, we all put in $100, you know, a year or whatever and stuff, but we're competing with, you know, gas prices and other type of consumer goods and falling wages and all these other kinds of things, as well as competing with all sorts of messaging that's dividing the community in even along like very like, you know, absurd lines at times, you know? So I think like if it was a case that it was like, oh, you can opt out of paying taxes that are supporting, you know, something else that the government does, and then just supply that into like these community projects or very specific kind of community kind of things, then yeah, that would be like non-precarious, you know. But the precarity exists not just because of the economic situation, but because, you know, you have a lot of like vested interests in not having that voice coming out, right? And those aren't losing any funding, you know.